The special Senate or Senate Special Committee on Budget to order. We have House Bill 5077 before us. We're going to have some public testimony today and tomorrow and maybe tomorrow evening. We served kind of short notice yesterday. The House passed over a K-12 budget with some revenues attached and figured in. We wanted to get some indication from people what they're thinking and kind of flesh out our own thoughts, frankly, as a committee on some of this stuff. So I'd like to begin by opening a public hearing on House Bill 5077. We have some people that have signed up to testify. We'll go down this sheet, and then I'll ask for those that have not. I guess I'll ask right off the bat, has anyone traveled over 100 miles to come here? Anyone traveled a long distance in the last 24 hours with all that advance notice we gave? Seeing none, we'll go to the list, and then I'll ask for people, as I said, afterwards that didn't quite make the sign-up list. I'd like to start with Ozzie Rose from COSA, please. Come forward.
Chair, could Mr. Marshall join me?
Yes, sir, that'd be fine. Mr. Marshall, would you please come forward?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good afternoon. John Marshall representing the Oregon School Boards Association. And thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the opportunity to visit with you today and express some concerns and views on the House-passed K-12 funding package. First, we'd like to recognize and appreciate the efforts of the House leadership to develop a 2003-05 K-12 funding package that meets the $5.3 billion minimum funding target set by the governor, the state superintendent, and K-12 advocates. But we believe that the House-passed bill has missed that mark. The House version purports to allocate $5.3 billion to schools, but depends on resources that may never materialize. First is a $50 million special appropriation made to the emergency board that may be released upon, quote, increases or decreases in federal funds, unquote, and $250 million that relies on an extraordinary state economic and revenue rebound in just the next 11 or 12 months. Of particular concern to my membership, the boards of the 198 school districts who must balance their budgets and plan the educational programs and services available to Oregon's 550,000 public school students over the next 2 years, these two features. First, the $50 million special appropriation. Right now, before Congress, is the appropriations bill for elementary secondary school funding throughout the nation. Chances are Congress will not get back to that until after their August recess. In dispute or under debate are provisions relating to appropriations to assist school districts with compliance with the two major federal mandates. That is the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, IDEA, and the No Child Left Behind Act. While our national associations and we are hopeful that the Congress will step up to the plate and fulfill its promise, particularly related to IDEA, but also No Child Left Behind, we're not sure at this point what kind of funds will be allocated. If there is, in fact, an increase in federal funds, does the language in this special appropriation mean that the emergency board will then not allocate those funds from that special appropriation? And if not, will then school districts be left to fund to provide those programs under those federal mandates, but not have the funds to support them? The language in House Bill 5077 is extremely ambiguous and offers no guarantee that school districts will actually receive those funds. The second feature of concern is the $250 million that would be allocated to schools in the second year based on a revenue forecast trigger. In order for those funds to materialize, the June 2004 revenue forecast must show at least a $781 million increase over the close of session forecast. And that, we believe, is an extraordinary economic recovery to suggest that will occur in just the next 10 or 11 months. Additionally, The provision requires spending funds this biennium that, because of the increase in revenue, must be returned to income taxpayers in the next under the surplus kicker law. So the expenditure of these funds this biennium merely creates an obligation into the next biennium. Because under normal circumstances, when your revenue increases beyond projections, that creates a larger ending balance, which is then offset in the next biennium by a decrease in revenue as a result of the kicker checks that go out. So you're in effect spending the same money twice and creating an obligation in 05-07. The other question we have is, how can school boards develop their 2004-05 school year budgets when their resources won't be known until the middle of June, when that forecast is released, just weeks before the law requires that we have our budgets balanced? We're hopeful that as the Senate works to prepare its version of a 2003-05 K-12 funding package, the misgivings of the House plan can be corrected and ultimately a clean $5.3 billion appropriation can be constructed that will meet the needs of Oregon students, school districts, the Oregon school districts and the students they serve. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Mr. Rose, anything to add? Senator Winter.
Thank you. I just have a question. When you say clean 5.3, and I'm assuming that's clean without the purse savings, what do you mean by clean?
What I'm referring to, Mr. Chairman and Senator Winters, is a clean appropriation in terms of cash, not based on monies that are allocated to the emergency board that may or may not flow to school districts, monies that are based on some kind of future occurrence. Many school districts have budgets in balance. Well, all school districts have their budgets balanced for this current school year, and they're beginning to try to plan for the not only maybe the second half of this school year, but also into the second year of the biennium. And I think the issue is clearly one where whatever appropriation you ultimately come up with, that it's laid on the table, and so school districts know exactly what their funding picture looks like for the next 2 years. We'd like to see 5.3.
Other questions?
Follow up. Some districts have budgeted or the PERS savings, and some have not. Is that not an accurate statement?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Winters, that's correct.
And so that their budgetary needs have varied when you did your survey of the districts. In your survey, taking in that variance, what was the number that you came up with?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Winters, Ozzie has some specific data that he would share, and I think many of your questions will be answered. But just to one point about the PERS savings, there was an order that went out to school districts back in late winter that suggested that the new PERS rate would be 18.58%. Following the legislature's enactments, the PERS board adjusted those rates, and it wasn't until June 30, that the final document from PERS went out to all public employers about what their rates would be for the fiscal year beginning July 1 of 2003. So budgets had to be balanced, had to be adopted. So there are a variety of rates. There were rumors circulating, well, the rate's not going to be 18.58. Maybe it will go down to 13 or 14. There was another concern raised, well, will the board adjust rates based on the existing 2001 valuation and then further adjusted because of the legislature's enactments, or will they look at 2002 as well as the current 2003 calendar year? And they finally decided they wouldn't look at they would stick with the 2001 valuation. They wouldn't look at 2002. They wouldn't look at 2003. So there's a concern out there on the part of school districts in terms of, do we adopt our budgets to go with the 11.11? Will that hold given the Supreme Court considerations? Will the board change rates if the Supreme Court makes a decision? Will the PERS board change rates if they do a new valuation and recognize that because of market circumstances over the last 2 years that rate needs to be increased? So there's a great deal of consternation on the part of school districts about exactly which PERS rate to use. So in a more direct answer to your question, There are 198 school districts out there. Have every single one of them have currently in place adopted budgets at a rate of 11.11? The answer would be no. Have some school districts decided not to spend that, quote, PERS savings because of that level of uncertainty? And the answer to that is yes.
Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Because I know that this would probably be a subject of discussion for this committee as it deliberates over the next 2 to 3 days, regarding the issue of PERS, we've had this discussion in terms of if schools were actually closing their doors early in the last school year, if they were laying off personnel, and if you were going to actually look at their actual reduction in costs, they would not be from a proposed rate, but from the rate that they were paying, which was 12.73. And their new rate is 11.11. So that would be your actual savings. But if you were, and just get your response, if you were to do that, then you should probably also, on the other side, take into consideration increases in health care costs. The reality is that many school districts were in the middle of contracts that they could not come back and basically take away salary increases or health care cost increases that were in the period of that contract. Because I think we have been trying to actually, as you see in this legislature, in terms of PERS benefits, it's been become sort of the, I'll compare it to, it's sort of the lottery fund of this session, where when we had the lottery before and everybody wanted to pay for everything with the lottery, now everybody wants to pay everything with PERS savings and not with real dollars. But we've had this discussion. If you could comment on that the savings is between 11 and 12.73, but then you should take into consideration the other cost increases also.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Devlin, I think in terms of real savings is defined as what you're paying now against what you'll be paying next week or next month. And if you're paying less, then there's obviously a savings that can be calculated.
Yeah.
I think where school districts are right now, and I think, again, Ozzie's data might shed a little bit more light on this. I don't believe there's a school district or a school board member in the state that wants to go through what schools went through in the last year, and that is trying to repair an airplane in flight, trying to make budget cuts during the course of a school year. That was very, very painful and unsettling. And so it's only natural that because many school districts over the last several years have spent down their ending cash balances, their reserves, their contingency funds at abysmally low levels, I think there's a great deal of conservatism, if you will, going on in terms of exactly what we budget for and how close to the margin we actually get. And given all the uncertainty, and now lawsuits have been filed, and there are folks that suggested that the Supreme Court in a wisp is going to overturn everything the legislature did and rates are going to shoot up tomorrow. That's a rumor out there. It may not be fact. But school districts are very, very nervous, and therefore they're trying to budget, I believe, responsibly, but they're, I think, maybe trying to budget a little liberal on the expenditure side and very conservative on the revenue side, so they don't end up in a circumstance where they don't have the resources to meet their requirements and therefore have to make budget cuts during the course of the school year.
Senator Gorley.
Mr. Chair, I will wait until Mr. Rose presents his data. It may answer a couple of questions I have.
Well, let's hear from Mr. Rose, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, I am Ozzie Rose with the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. Schools across the state have made staff and program reductions over the past year and will continue to do so at a funding level of either 505 or $5.3 billion. But make no mistake, there is a significant difference between 505 and $5.3 billion. I said that yesterday in one of my lobby hacks. Said I already made a profound statement. There's a difference between 5.05 and 5.3. But in terms of schools, it means, and that the sheet that you have that I handed out to you on the back one side of it lists, and I asked, when I sent that out, I asked, by the way, all of the districts on that list are using 11.11% as their PERS rate. We were recommending a lower PERS rate to our people in the budget-making process back in mid-May, and we kept pushing it down as we learned more and more about what we thought was going to happen. All those districts are using 11.11%.
And what I asked, what I was asking for, does it make any difference to you if we get 503 rather than 505? Because it kind of seemed like, but we argued from day one, and I'll tell you why in a minute. Neither one of those are adequate. We ought to be talking 5556, et cetera. You have some problems that we aren't going to be able to do that. And I understand that. But it seemed to me the debate was between 505 and 503. Does it make any difference to school programs and what goes on for kids? And so that was what I was after when I got that data. In Albany, it means restoring 17 certified staff positions and 6 classified. In Brookings, restores 8 additional days if they don't currently have budgeted and 2 certified positions. Coos Bay, 8 days and 4 certified. Crook County, 10 certified positions. North Bend, 9 days and 7 certified. Salem-Keizer, 23 elementary teachers right away, 20 additional secondary teachers at the start of the second semester. Tigard, 20 to 45, replacing the 64 that they've cut over the last 2 years. And when he reasonably says 20 to 40, they could afford 40, but they probably can't ramp up staff that fast if we don't know this final number for another couple, 3 weeks, and so on. And a closer look at the numbers tell you why is this so. And the other chart on the other side is some data I want to kind of summarize for you. The 2001-2000 school year, when we left here in 2001, we had a budget, et cetera. We funded schools at $5,248 per weighted student. And then, as you know, we had a little difficulty along the way during the next 2 years. And when it was all over with, the funding for schools on a per weighted student basis in the 2002-2003 school year, the one we just completed, the actual funding was $4,600, $4,681 per weighted student, a 10.8% reduction from what we'd had the prior year. If you use the accrual process, which allowed us to, not more money, but allowed us to fix our books so it looked like we had more money for 02-03, you actually had $4,990 per weighted student, and that's still a 4.9% reduction from the prior year. We were reducing things all throughout this past year. The House proposal that comes to you provides $5,166 per weighted student next year. That's a 10.4% over our actual money last time, which is almost identical to the 10.8% we lost from the prior year. And the same thing on if you work against the accrual, and you can work against either one of those numbers for whatever reason you want to use. But above the accrual level, it's up 3.5%, almost offsets the 4.9% drop when you figure it that way the prior year. The $5.3 billion level, $5,402 per student next year, that's a 15% increase over the actual. So we get to start restoring the things we've been cutting, or it's an 8% increase over the accrual. $5.3 billion makes a difference, and it makes a difference in terms of fewer layoffs, lower class sizes, restoring programs we've cut, eliminating fees we've been passing on to kids, or reducing the amount we passed on to kids, and begins to restore what we had for schools in the past. But even at that level, $5.3 billion on a dollar per student rate, we're only up 2.9% from where we were 2 years ago. So it's not a huge change in terms of when you set aside inflation, et cetera. It is not, does not keep up with inflation. The issues that we argue a lot about what these numbers mean, and it's pretty easy to talk about 5.1, 5.3, 5X, and look at schools from that perspective, but I kind of liken it to and Senator, this is not, I didn't think about you when I've been using this analogy, I'm sorry, but a 30,000-foot flyover look at the school budgets, as opposed to the ground zero where building administrators and teachers and superintendents are putting together classes for this September 8th, how many kids are in them, how many books they're going to have, how many teachers you're going to have in your building, et cetera, et cetera. That's why the districts need to know what are we actually getting for students so we can make some good judgments about what we have. And there is a difference in how you look at it. The issue on PERS, and again, sorry, Senator, I was talking to one of your superintendents today. Klamath County has 13% schedule for their PERS.
It's funny how that works.
Pardon? And not 11.11. But they just got their notice on their increase in health costs, and they only budgeted 7% growth in health costs, and the two are going to offset each other. Roseburg ended the school year, and there's nobody up here from Roseburg, ended the school year with a $3,000 ending fund balance on a $40 million budget. If he gets any additional money, most of it's going to be placed in his ending fund balance, because $3,000 against $40 million is not anywhere near adequate. Pendleton and Lincoln County, again, there's nobody here from those two districts, but there are people I've been talking to. They have made their cuts. Pendleton's cut 60-some teachers over the last 2 years. They've got their budgets in place, and they're working on their 0405 budget, which will take a significant hit in terms of their, and they're starting to work on how do I move some of this money forward. Because you really got to, if you're a school person, and it's August of 03, you really have to be thinking about September of 05 as well as, I mean, September of 04 as well as September of 03. And so some of that rolls into this. Most districts, Salem, I know their so-called purse savings, the difference when they originally thought it was safety, they've spent half of it, and they're putting half of it, trying to hedge on what they think might happen with the increase. And what we do know about the PERS increase, the PERS will not increase during this biennium. 11.11 will hold for the 2 years. Notwithstanding what the court does. I think most of us who know very much about it believe that and believe it will stay that way. What we also know is that even if the court supports everything that we've done, there's still going to be an increase in the PERS rate because of the investment stuff. That where the 2002 investments, when they all get factored in, there is going to be a rate increase beginning in September or July of 05. And if they throw out some of what you did, by the way, I think the legislature did an amazing job with PERS. I would have bet lots of money you couldn't have done the things you've done. And I don't suspect all of you like all of it, but I think you did an amazing job putting that thing through the political process. But if part of it gets thrown out, yes, we're going to have higher rates. And so do you, knowing you're going to have that, how far out on a limb do you go spending your money down and put new programs that you're going to turn around and cut in less than 10 months? So that kind of thinking goes on in the back of those minds out there. With that, I'd be pleased to try to answer any of your questions.
Questions? Senator Gordley and Senator Morse.
Thank you very much, and thank you, Mr. Rose. Back on June 17th, you provided for every legislator a memorandum outlining what various funding levels would mean for our districts all across the state. And as I've listened to your testimony thus far and looking at the page that you've provided to us, it gives us somewhat of an update of what a given funding level may mean to our districts across the state. But I'm wondering if you could update some information for us. You said back on June 17th that in your survey of local districts, and at that time you had received responses from 79 districts serving 52% of Oregon's school-age population, that only 11 of the responding districts would be able to restore their 2002-03 school year at a funding level of less than $5.3 billion. And you said that more than half of the responding districts require a funding level of 5.5 or higher to restore their school year. And so one of my questions is, do you have an update of this information that reflects what the reality is for each of the 198 districts?
Ms. Chair, Senator Gurley, the answer is no. All I have is those responses. And those responses are, what would it take to fully restore 0203? What I did different over the last 10 days, because I felt the debate had narrowed quite a bit, is what could you do? Because a lot of your colleagues and other folks said things like, well, I hear they're building budgets at 4.8 or 4.7 or 4.9, so why would we give them more money? They balanced budgets. They were required to produce balanced budgets. And, yes, they balanced budgets on lower numbers, but they did a lot of program reduction and things in order to balance those budgets. So my question to them, it appears that 505 is on the table and we're arguing over 50 to 53. What would you do with the additional, what could you restore with the additional 250? So ask the question differently. I believe that my original numbers still stand.
Okay, and if I may follow up, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Rose. In the same memorandum and in the supporting documents, by my count, there were then at least 36 districts reporting that they would need 5.6 or above in order to restore their planned programs for a school year. And you explained that a planned school year is not just a number of days, that it's a planned educational program and services, not just a number of days. Can you tell us if the number 36 has shifted one way or the other?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I don't believe the number shifted because the question was the same. And I was trying to get across the point then because a lot of people around here were talking about, well, if we can get this minimum number of days. And I don't believe a school year is a number of days. It's a set of things that happen on those days. And even the difference in the new data, ask you, what would you restore if we got this other $250 million? I told them how to compute for the district what it meant to them. And some said I'd hire teachers. Some said I'd restore some days. All of them are running the minimum days. Nobody's adopted a budget for next year that doesn't meet the minimum requirement. But they're running fewer days than they ran at some time in the past, and they'd like to restore. Because prior to the problems we've had, nobody ran just the minimum number of days or hours. They ran a school program that their citizens won that community. And so the original data says, what would it take to fully restore what you used to do? And I was trying to get a handle on, trying to use an argument with you folks that 5.3 wasn't enough, or 5.5, 5.6. And I think my argument still holds, but you're no longer arguing over those other numbers. And so I tried to take a different tact. This is what you're often asking, what would you buy? Why would we do this? And because you've already balanced a budget. Well, yeah, you balanced a budget. But you balance a budget that doesn't serve your community.
Mm-hmm. And my final question, Mr. Chair, goes to that point. And I'm asking the question of Mr. Rose and Mr. Marshall, but I'm also asking it of all of us. Why are we willing to settle for 5.3, which you acknowledge is a minimum level of funding, when we know, hopefully, that it will not adequately meet the needs of at least 36 districts?
The question, Senator, to me is why would I settle for that?
It's a question that I'm asking to both of you, but I'm also asking it to all of us.
My only answer to it is I can't get 36 votes in the House and 18 votes in the Senate to raise enough revenue to do what I think ought to be done. And so what do I have a shot at in terms of what I am working with? And it appears you've defined the parameters into these areas, and I'm doing the best I can to do the best I can with that set of parameters. But it is not serve kids where they ought to be served. There's no way other way to say that.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Gourley, I think the issue is that, as Ozzie suggested, we don't believe it's possible to get from where we are to the step up to where we want to be. But it is possible to get from where we are to create a ramp so we'll ultimately end up where we ought to be. And that's what we're focused on right now. How can, at the funding level that's under discussion and on the table, identify for you exactly what that will mean, school district by school district, that is on the ground kind of a picture, and I think we've tried to do that. Are we doing what's right? No. Are we doing what's right in human services or higher education or community colleges or public safety? Absolutely not. I think we're at the point now of identifying not what we ought to be doing, but what we're able to do. And we're trying to show you that we believe that you ought to be able to get to 5.3, and we're trying to identify exactly what that means.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
Good questions. Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The difference between 5.05 and 5.3 you've referenced as restoring days and, to paraphrase, restoring programs and services. If you could talk just a moment about the collective bargaining dynamic and at that additional money that's, let's assume that it is appropriated, How does the collective bargaining dynamic figure into where those monies are allocated? If you could address that, I would appreciate that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, if the contracts are already in place, you have some obligations to those contracts unless you can get them reopened and renegotiate different numbers. And that's probably have whether you can or cannot get that done with your labor union. Some districts did this past year. Salem gave up their COLAs this year. Tigard's teachers got a 3% salary increase this last year and then turned around and voluntarily, before they bargained, gave up 5 days, 2% of their salary, total salary back. So there are instances where that kind of thing's going on. Health things are already in the contract. Many health insurance programs are up in October. They'll have to negotiate new ones or whatever, and that'll be on the table. I think if you go out and examine the contracts that are being worked on, that districts have done a pretty decent job with the settling with their staff over next year. It's going to be hard times and lower increases. If the contract's in place, which many of them are three-year contracts, you have to get the unions to voluntarily open up and rethink about it. Now, so what happens to this $250 million? It'll be distributed for teachers and books, et cetera, and within the context of whatever contract's in place in that school district at that time.
Are there reopener provisions if funds increase typically in these labor agreements?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, I don't know. I doubt that, but I don't know. Pardon? Are they?
I don't think so.
They don't let my members bargain, so I don't get as involved in this as some issues. But I don't think so.
The information that we have been provided would suggest that there are opportunities for reopening, both going down and going up.
Yeah.
So it's it cuts both ways.
Yeah.
But that's, I think, is an issue to be concerned about. Is will we realize the benefit for the children in the classroom, with supplies, curriculum, days in school, and services and programs, or will it be all taken into increased labor costs? And that's not, I don't make that comment, Mr. Chair, excuse me, lightly, because I do recognize we need to be very, very sensitive to providing adequate benefits and compensation. But these are not usual times, and so I just raise that issue as a concern.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, your concern, I understand your concern. It's probably interesting. Unless you get in and start looking at everything, some school districts have already made some cuts and may have to go back to the table to get themselves competitive with other people. Some areas, if you're looking for special ed, everybody's talking about, one of the ideas from the legislators is, you're going to get rid of all these high-priced people because they retired and you're going to replace them with cheap ones or less expensive ones. And if it's a special ed person, that's not going to happen. Special ed people are hard to find. In Salem, they pay a bonus to a special ed teacher that will sign on. The market drives some of that. By the way, if you're looking for special ed jobs, Roseburg needs 3 middle school special ed teachers. Okay. Grants Pass needs 2 high school. Lincoln County needs 1, and they promise they have better weather. This stuff's going over the Internet right now, and people looking for those teachers.
Good question.
Mr. Chairman, if I might respond to Senator Morris's question, I think the question you raised is one that will be a question that's asked in probably hundreds of school districts around the state as they look at those reopeners as well as contracts that come up for renewal, but the boards and their employee representatives go into bargaining. Here's the amount of money we have on the table. Here are our needs in terms of adding new personnel, for example, for reading specialists or math specialists to meet the requirements of No Child Left Behind and so forth. How can we balance out the needs of attracting and retaining good people, and that is enhancing the salaries and benefits of existing employees, versus spending it on instructional materials or textbooks or building improvements and so forth? And those are fundamental questions, and I think will be asked and answered in the course of the natural processes that school districts go through when they sit down and try to come to an agreement under Oregon's Public Employees Collective Bargaining Law.
Senator Winters, then Senator Harper, then Senator...
Ozzie, you've mentioned Salem a lot. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we've had quite a discussion in Salem about the amount of ending balance. I know the local newspaper had written quite a bit about it. On average, can you tell us what is expected as an ending balance within your school district and how much currently is it existing in the school districts across the state?
Mr. Chair, Senator Lynch, there is no accepted amount that drives, there's no ORS and so forth, and I don't know the answer to the total question. Ending balances have been brought down a lot over the last 4 years, like I said, Roseburg guy talked to me, so I know what his situation is. Most of them are much lower than they used to be and have people concerned. And I don't know specifically.
Are you planning to, you know, you conduct a lot of surveys. Are you planning to include that as one of your surveys?
I can do that. By the way, we're trying to get the Salem superintendent in here tomorrow, and she can answer the question directly.
Well, I know what Salem says.
Okay.
I just
because
we've had a lot of discussion in our community with respect to the ending balance.
Senator Harper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John, I've got a flush out what Senator Morris was talking about, a copy of the contract. This is from Sherwood. I understand this is pretty much boilerplate. That'll reopen the agreement if the funding increases by 5%, which that would be the trigger at the 5-3 level. I guess we were just kind of curious whether this was standard across the system or this is an aberration, or if our focus is the kids in the classroom, school days, and reasonable class sizes, if we reopen all these contracts, if we bump this money up to that level, I mean, will that get to the kids, or will it be increased compensation? That's all I think we're trying to get to. Just want to make sure we have a feel for where this money will ultimately end up if we go down this road. So that's really what it was.
Yeah, Mr. Vice Chair, I think that's a very good question. And during the course of the Education Subcommittee's discussion of the K-12 appropriation, our Labor Relations Director was before the committee sharing a wealth of information we have from our database about contracts and settlements and so forth, and gave quite a bit of information to Ms. McGlashan. The question you've asked in terms of reopeners in an increasing revenue environment, I don't believe was asked, but I'll certainly get an answer to that question and get it back to you within the next 24 hours.
Okay, I was told that this is kind of your boilerplate. If it is, that means it would be, you know, fairly widespread. Just kind of curious as to what's out there. Okay, thanks.
Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Marshall, Mr. Rose, both of you have a lot more experience with this issue than I do, but one of the things that I've noticed in my years beyond being a voter and a parent started actually when my son was in the third grade in Tigard-Tualatin School District, about being really focused on school funding issues and interested in the ramifications of those. By the way, my son will be a junior at Linfield this year, so it's been a while. But one of the things I'd like you to comment on, we get all these comments about, well, what is the specific impact of this or what is the specific impact of that? What I found in looking at school funding issues is that you've got 198 school districts out there, that you can't really make any generalizations in terms of, like, saying that all school districts will be fine at 5.05 in one region of the state, or all school districts will be fine at 5.3, because I find, regardless of where you go, whether it's Eastern Oregon, Southern Oregon, Central Oregon, the coast, you will have school districts that will probably do okay at 5.3, but you'll have school districts that will still be cutting programs at 5.3. We always try to look for sort of like one shoe fits all. We literally have at least 198 feet out there.
That's good, Richard. Thank you.
But I'm just trying to get, we try to make these generalizations, and I come from maybe a different perspective than some people in terms of my district, but most of my school districts were flat funded after Measure 5 because they had a long history of supporting public education funding. and the ability to do that, to be fair. But 99 was about the first year that they got out of being flat funded. And basically what you're telling me in terms of Mr. Rose's comments is that they got out of being flat funded in 99, and even at 5.3, for all practical purposes, they've been flat funded since then, or pretty close to it. At 5.05, they would certainly be flat funded since then. I don't know, I'm looking for a...
Well, your first question, it's very clear. They're all there. There's 190 difference, and you cannot say this happens in all districts. The interesting thing about our that we lose track of is our 198 districts, 99 of them, half of them only serve 6% of our kids. And the average size of those 99 districts is 313 kids. Our class size issue in that set of districts is different than the 18 of our districts serve 52% of our kids. Class size issues are different in those 18 districts than they are in the others. But it doesn't mean that we don't have to serve all the kids in all those districts. And the issue of generalizations is, and I try to do this all the time, before you start talking about averages and generalizations, be sure you cut down through the data far enough you know what you're doing. But the answer to your question is correct. One district, same size here and same size there, different situation in terms of what this set of dollars will do.
Senator Messerly, and then we'll get the treasurer up to talk, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually have two questions I'd like to raise. First of all, hopefully it will be easier, and maybe you have to get back to us. But when we did the education, working through the education committee and working through the quality education model, we tried to get all the figures and everything combined and the assumptions combined so that we could make a fair comparison. But I've been curious as to, on the dealing with the insurance cost, how much variance there is from one district to the other. And I've seen one publication from OSBA, I think, some time ago, and I was quite shocked, quite frankly, of how much difference it is from one district to another as to what their insurance costs. If you want to provide information in the future, that would be fine, or if you wanted to respond.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Messerly, I think that the variance in costs from on the part of school districts is dependent on the extent to which they have negotiated agreements with their employee representatives regarding caps. That is, caps on the amount of the district's contribution and the portion of those premiums borne by the employees. And you take that circumstance, and most school districts, I would guess, have probably their administrators have their own way of determining what their salaries and benefits are. Then you have the licensed teachers, and then you have the classified employees, and they could be different for each one of those groups. So I think that's the reason for the variance. And we've got a database that where we try to collect as much information as we can from school districts about their employee, both their salary and benefit costs. And if there's a specific question that you have, I'd certainly be more than pleased to try to track down the answer.
Thank you. I would be very interested in the both for the certified and the classified as to between districts across the state how those costs vary. Mr. Chair, could I have another follow-up, please? Also, as we worked through the quality education model, it became very apparent to me that although the model, I think, for quality education is very good, it became very apparent that the distribution formula for the state of Oregon, I believe, is flawed. And it does not work when you try to maintain that quality of education across districts of the state who are losing enrollment in differing degrees and for extended periods of time. I realize that's a very political thing, and it's going to be very difficult to change, but if we're going to work through this and talk about costs of education and try to maintain quality education and no child left behind, I think we have to address that issue. Probably not going to happen this session, but I think we need to work in the interim towards that.
Senator Messer, I agree, and it's not only an issue of declining enrollment, because about two-thirds of Oregon school districts are in declining enrollment circumstances, but it's also an issue of the constantly changing demographic mix of students and the challenges that demographic mix changes, particularly as it relates to No Child Left Behind and trying to move all children up that achievement ladder.
Good comment. Thank you. Good questions. Thank you. Well, thank you, gentlemen. Let's have the
chair. May
yes,
I'd love
sir,
to,
Mr. Rose.
I want to share with you that as a body, you have an opportunity to do something none of your predecessors have done. You may get to meet on Labor Day in consecutive years.
Oh, you could have done without telling us.
You're doing pretty good there for a while, Ms. Rose.
Leave it to us.
We get the state treasurer, Randall Edwards, to come on up.
On that.
I'm minor, so I'll give us a mark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is State Treasurer Randall Edwards. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you about this budget before you and the importance of this budget. First, the first thing I want to talk about is the need to move budgets very quickly and to get a balanced budget in a very short order. I sent all of you a letter a little over 3 weeks ago talking about why it was important for the state to come up with a balanced budget in a very short order, that is within the first week of August. And I want to just give you a little more detail about what that meant and what does it mean to us as we continue to move on beyond that. And the reason why I want to bring that up here, this is certainly one of the biggest budgets you're going to be looking at. It's important for the schools of the state to have a number, but it's also important for the state to move forward and get a balanced budget and beat Mr. Rose's prediction of Labor Day. The reason why I want to highlight a couple of things. One is a chart that shows the biennial budgets and the cash imbalances, if you will, since the 97-99 budget. And the issue of cash and cash management, while may not have been important in the past, it is one of cost. And what I want to suggest to you, when you look at this chart, the last triangular plotting shows that in this biennium, like the last biennium, we will have an imbalance between the revenues coming into the state and the bills that we have to pay. And the important part of this is there's a cost associated to the state every time we are under that solid line in the middle, which is a zero cash balance. The longer you wait to get a balanced budget, the more it's going to cost. In fact, it's costing us now to borrow internally, and it will cost us more as we continue to go into August to the extent that we are looking at having to do some financings of liquidating potentially longer-term investments to pay for short-term needs. So that's really what this chart is showing you, is a historical moment in the state's history, of at least a modern history, of an imbalance in our collections and expenditures. And if you can see the lines, the trend is we've been sinking, if you will, over the last few bienniums. And then when the recession hit, it put us under the zero balance. And the point with that is we did not have ending fund balances as we started a whole new biennium. And as a result, when we came into this biennium, we started to have to pay bills immediately. And the immediacy of that became apparent as we looked at the size of the bills that we had to pay, which is close to $1 billion over the next couple of months. That's one thing. The cost of what this is going to cost you, and again, I think you're going to be looking at budgets. Since I sent that letter out, we know now what it cost us last biennium to maintain a cash position for the state of Oregon, and that's on the second sheet. If you look at the top numbers, talking about $22.3 million, those were short-term borrowings. The 13-month notes that we issued was about $15.7 million. And borrowing internally, that is floating the state from funds that I have available, cost us almost $6 million. So all that adds up to $22.3 million. The next line, which shows total debt service, as you recall, last spring we found ourselves in a dire situation, and I was asked by the legislature to sell $450 million in an appropriation credit, a bond, if you will, for 10 years. And that line shows both the total cost of the issuance, that is $571 million, the initial issuance, the amount of money that you got in the general fund, which is $450 million, so the difference being the interest cost and the issuance cost to achieve that $450 million. Those are real money. These are real dollars. And if you recall, that was to bridge us through the last 3 to 4 months of the biennium in order for us to have a balanced budget. The point here is it cost us for the last biennium $143 million to finance us through the situation we were in the last biennium. And again, if you want to look at what it's going to cost you as you go into this biennium, it's these numbers underneath the debt service relating to the $41.8 million. Those are annual payments we will be paying on those bonds for the next 10 years, both principal and interest. So that's less money that you have today to pay for programs that you're looking at today and in the future. So that's the cost, the total cost for us to manage, having tried to manage this crisis that we've been in for the last 5-6 months as far as balancing our budget at the end of the biennium, and the cost in the out years, in the future bienniums, of what you're going to be looking at, less dollars to the state of Oregon. And again, the reason why I bring this up is urgency. Time is of the essence that you get a balanced budget so that I can go out and go on the note market to bridge this gap that we see today to make sure that we can pay our bills in the least costly way to the state of Oregon. But there are costs in today's budget as well. To the point of $5.3 billion and the issue before you in this budget, it seems to me you're in tough economic times. It is also an opportunity to invest in the state of Oregon. And educating our children is one area that you can make an investment. The $5.3 billion that you're considering on this side is a much better investment in the future of the state of Oregon, particularly in light of educating our children. Too many children were shortchanged last year because of cuts to the school budget. More than 90 school districts, large and small, urban and rural, cut school days. This budget must be the starting point of renewing our commitment to improving education funding in Oregon. The $5.3 billion is that start. At least it begins to restore some of the devastating cuts that were made last year. However, our job is not done once this budget is passed. Our system of financing our schools is broke and broken. We must look at long-term adequacy and stability for school funding. For example, we must modify the kicker law to allow us to have revenue cushions when we hit another economic recession. And I know there's been a great interest in getting something passed by this body, the Senate, to do that. But we also must look at the long-term funding system itself, and that is looking at tax reform. No other state in the country is as reliant as Oregon on the wobbly, inadequate, and unreliable income tax as we are. And this stool that we've created, this one-legged stool, is even more flimsy when you start looking at how we've diversified our economy, depending more and more on a technology sector, which again creates tenuous wealth and greater business swings. We now have an entire K-12 school system, or an entire school system, K-16, dependent upon this one-legged stool. And that, in my mind, is what makes this recession different and the debate over tax reform different than in the past. I know you've got a lot of tough decisions to make to get a balanced budget. However, time is of the essence. You need to move quickly on this budget and other budgets. For each passing day, it is becoming more and more expensive for the state to operate without a balanced budget. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions, and I appreciate your discussion this issue.
Senator Gordley.
Thank you very much, Treasurer Edwards, and really appreciate the urgency in the message that you are bringing to us. And I'd like to ask you if, in your statement about the one stool and the need for tax reform, are you also urging us to do tax reform, to take that on now? I'm asking you to address the issue of timing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Gordley, I have stated publicly that tax reform needs to be done in an expedient way as possible. And I know it's really more of a political question than it is potentially a policy question, although they're very intermingled. I go back to this chart. This is an unhealthy business model we have got a cash problem. It's a signal that we have a problem with the financing of the state of Oregon. I think it's fair to say that during the 90s, when we even had one of the fastest growing economies in the country, and many in this room can attest to that, school districts across the state were beginning to feel the pinch of ballot measure 5. If there's an indication that we have a problem with the financing of our schools and in large part to our whole system of state government, it is where we sit today and the debates we're having today about how we're going to provide adequate services in Oregon. And this budget is a point in which you need to debate and prove to the public that there is a will and a willingness to look at the long term, not only the short term, but the long term needs of the state of Oregon. And tax reform is part of that.
Senator Winters.
I have a couple of questions. And one is that, we are in a cash flow problem and serious one. Are you also suggesting that we throw away our credit card?
Could you, Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, could you clarify the credit card?
Well, we're in this. We borrowed a lot. Mm-hmm. We're functioning basically on credit. The short-term borrowing has created a problem. And so, if you're looking at public policy, I raise that, I'm serious, are you also suggesting that perhaps we need to throw away our credit card and not borrow?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, if I hear what you're saying, what I'm suggesting is borrowing on the note market and cash management through the notes, given the size of our shortfalls as outlined in that first handout, it is the cheapest and most prudent way to manage this cash imbalance. So businesses get lines of credit. We're saying we need a line of credit. If that's the credit card, no, I don't think you get rid of that. What I am concerned about, and if this is where you're going, because I've heard this in the building, of long-term bonding for short-term operating, that is fiscally irresponsible. And I'm hearing more and more about let's bond for some amount to plug the budget and get out of here. If there's any reality, it's looking at the costs for today and in the future bienniums of the borrowing for $450 million. We have done that once. We did it in a crisis. Don't plan a budget around a future issuance of a bond to again, in the hopes that that will get us out of this building. It's bad fiscal policy, and it would be a mistake to do that.
I guess I'm also talking about that you don't borrow for operational purposes. In business,
yes,
you don't.
And long-term borrowing for operation is bad fiscal policy. Let me make that clear. That's what I'm saying.
No, you talked about the one-legged stool, and I, often we look to our neighbor to the north and our neighbor to the south, and our neighbor to the south has three legs on its stool, and yet that neighbor has a $38 billion deficit. So, help me when we try to learn the lesson from other states. What can we do to not repeat the problems that are occurring in California? Our neighbor to the north also is in deficit spending, and I think they have two legs on their stool. So I would like to have some kind of discussion about if you have three legs, how do you still avoid having a huge deficit?
I didn't know I had an hour to be here. Let me just hit that very quickly, and I'd be happy to talk to you in more detail about that, but everybody tends to point to California, three-legged stool, and they've got a crisis, a huge crisis. They're obviously got a political crisis with a recall, which, by the way, if you didn't follow in the paper, the credit rating agencies downgraded that state to BBB, which is just above junk rating. So it is having implications on their finances short and long term. And your question is one of how should we stabilize a system of financing for this state. Well, in the first step, in my mind, goes to something that Senator Morris has been interested in. What about the kicker? Assuming we continue on with the tax system we've got, if we look back the last 5 to 6, 7 years, we set ourselves up for this train wreck. We had no ability to put money aside when we knew at some point this party was going to end. And as a result, we have a volatile income tax. It was hyperventilating. up, and then when that party ended, we had nothing in the bank, no ending fund balances, and then when we hit this recession, we dove in the deep end, and therefore cash management became a big problem and challenge for me and for the state. So I think the fair thing to say is the system we've got is very volatile, and looking around the country, we have been hit as hard as any other state. In fact, I think next to California, almost the hardest state in the country. And California's got a myriad of other problems beyond their tax system.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a follow-up question?
Quickly.
Quickly. Let's assume we have another driver that we don't talk about, which creates an uncertainty in both financing and revenue, and even if we, let's say that the kicker no longer became an issue, how do we reconcile? We are an initiative-driven state, and if I look at Measure 5, that was driven by a local initiative. If I look at, we're talking about other things that have impacted the financing inside of this building, that it's not what this body has done, but has come from the citizen population. So how do you take and balance all of that to assure that you have stable funding?
In 30 seconds or less.
It's a tough group. Small issues. There are multiple areas you need to look at. Obviously, I don't want to leave the impression there's not an issue of looking at expenditures. And again, this is a part of your job is to look at every budget and decide where the priorities of the state with the governor and decide how you're going to balance that budget. I'm suggesting in the quality education model that Senator Messley talked about earlier, began a roadmap of where we probably should be heading in expenditures on our K-12 system. We know some things we didn't know that long ago. When Measure 5 passed, it was also sold as an ability for the state would have the ability to pick up fully the cost of that new mandate. That mandate now is the biggest budget item in the state's budget, and it's only growing, and it will only continue to grow. And the debates you continue to have in this building, in this room, really are only going to get tougher and tougher. And interesting what was said by Senator Devlin about what the issue of one size fits none. This is one issue that, again, Measure 5 left us with, which is a state-funded school system still somehow locally trying to control it and manage it, but not be able to fund it. And that friction and that inability for local control or more local control is also part of the problem that's vested in this budget. How, in the end, do you make sure, and whatever your goals are, the governor stated them just the other day, class size, no cutting school days. How do you make sure that happens? And again, it's still at the local level how they're going to fund their, how they're going to take this money and fund themselves. But I think that begs again for, in the tax reform debate, how much local control do you allow? And part of that local control comes from financing themselves and having the ability to meet some of the unique aspects of your school districts and the values in that community.
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Treasurer, if I was Oregon's banker, I wouldn't loan Oregon any money. Not with this trend line, because what that tells me is that structurally we're not addressing the problems, because we're continuing to project a declining performance and increasing borrowing and living on the credit card that Senator Winters is talking about. I know that we're beyond the scope somewhat of the bill that we're hearing, but this issue is one that this assembly needs to come to grips with quickly and with a great deal of urgency, because from a financial perspective, this is a formula for disaster.
If I might just respond, I agree, and you've been very instrumental, Senator, in really digging into what's behind not only the cash needs but the structural imbalance that you've seen, mm-hmm. and the many mandates that Senator Winters just spoke about that are driving the costs of the state's budget. And we do need, and I really appreciate the leadership you've been providing to try to make some changes to that, because I can manage this. That we can get through this biennium. I can get the notes issued, and we can manage this on a cash basis. But it also begs, how do you change this? And that's sort of the discussion Senator Winters is asking. How do we? And you're asking, how do we address that? And that's something that this legislature right now can't take on. We need to get the budget balanced so that I can address this issue. And school districts can open their doors.
Can you help us in reducing spending so we can get this line back up to zero?
I
didn't think so.
As I said, Senator, there are issues of spending, but I would say the cost drivers and the senator from Albany can certainly show you what is driving the costs of these budgets in a very macro way, which I think is a very telling point.
Any other questions for? Thank you.
Thanks.
Lori, David Williams.
Good afternoon, committee members, Mr. Chair. For the record, Lori Wimmer Whalen, representing the Oregon Education Association. I have 44,000 members, down 1,000 since last year. I'd like to change course just a little bit with your indulgence and speak about not only the number, but also the children we serve, because after all, the numbers game really is only important to the extent that we are discussing what it is that we can provide by way of a quality education for the children of the state. In the ideal world, the legislative process would begin with a construction of a budget for K-12 that asks first, what are our educational goals and how much will it take to achieve them? In this ideal world, we'd carefully scrutinize all the inputs for that education and determine the resources that were needed to achieve certain outcomes. We'd factor in the truth that not all children come to us with equal capacities. We'd account for the fact that they differ in learning styles, some have disabilities, all of which requires extra support. We'd acknowledge that more than 60 languages are spoken in the homes of the students we educate. Nevertheless, we would assume that all children can learn if given the opportunity and the resources. We'd develop our educational programs and the budgets to fund them based on these straightforward facts, and all students would attain high standards with respect to learning gains taught by dedicated, qualified, and talented educators. The good news is that much of this groundwork has been done. The quality education model has determined the funding level that it would take for 90% of our students to reach these high standards. We also have a new federal law that mandates that 100% of students meet these high standards, although I would add parenthetically that the funding has not come forward commensurate with that particular rather high standard. And by the way, it's upon pain of funding withdrawal if we don't reach these standards by 2014. So the standards, the vision, the cost models have all been developed. Indeed, Oregon has mandated these standards in the Education Act for the 21st century. Most of us acknowledge that Oregon's economic health and our future depend on setting our course toward the achievement of these goals, and yet we falter in the midst of this two-year economic crisis that's diminished not only our revenue supply, but evidently also our will. The quality education funding model says that it will cost $6.5 billion to bring 90% of the students to standard. And again, as I said, this is not the 100% mandated by No Child Left Behind. It's 90% in the 2003-05 biennium. Clearly, the money's just not going to be there for that, so it remains a pipe dream. In the alternative, our organization has spent 7 months arguing for at least a restoration budget to build back from the cuts from the last year, one that keeps pace with inflation and student enrollment increases in the ensuing 2 years, and that is in effect a hold harmless budget at the 2001 level. That price tag, adjusted for the 11.11% PERS rate, is $5.58 billion, or some people have been rounding up, 5.6. Sadly, even this funding level seems to be a casualty of these difficult economic and political times. Now, the highest funding level still considered politically possible is the governor's level of $5.3 billion. Not full funding, to be sure, but significantly better than the House budget sent over that you have received with only 4.9 hard cash in it. We're asking this committee to boost the funding in House Bill 5077 to at least a $5.3 billion level. We believe, and research shows, that public education is the key to Oregon's economic recovery. This is a truism in several respects. First, if dollars to education are cut, not only do our students suffer and our staff suffers, but so too does the local economy of each of the communities in which those schools are located. In more than 50%, for example, of the communities in Oregon, the public school is the largest employer in those communities. Education dollars normally circulate in those local communities and provide significant stimulus to the businesses in those areas. Last year, we co-commissioned with the OSBA a study by Eco Northwest to take a look at the effect of staff layoffs in those local communities and found that the impacts were significant, particularly in the rural areas of the state. Secondly, the quality of public education, business leaders have told us, is a leading factor in determining corporate relocation, expansion, and certainly talent recruitment for Oregon-based businesses. As our national reputation has been sullied by the blows we've weathered in the past year, businesses have lost potential executives concerned about enrolling their children in a school system that has been so dramatically cut. That's been over $500 million in the last year. Finally, public education is also an economic engine because our business is to prepare future generations to participate in the global economy and to educate students accordingly. We must maintain the historically high level of achievement Oregon schools have attained over time. It's easy to proclaim that this body is putting education first. I've heard it for the last week. But are we really prioritizing public education? Not at $4.9 billion, we're not. That number is a 16% reduction from the full funding budget we have just told you we advocate. It's also 9% shy. The governor's budget is also 9% shy of full funding, but it appears to us that it would be a reasonable compromise under the circumstances. Without this, Oregon school children will see, and you'll hear more about this tomorrow from our members who are coming from around the state, program cuts, class sizes swelling, loss of education staff, and even shortened school years. Some may ask, and I've heard it even today in a way, why can't all the employees just take a pay cut to balance the budgets? Well, in too many places, they have. Not only have students sacrificed 10 million educational hours in this most recent school year, but that loss has translated to, just in the teaching staff, that doesn't count administrators and classified, $36 million of salary that my members have forgone. For those who are reluctant to raise taxes to meet the true needs of Oregon, I would ask, isn't this in effect a special tax on teachers? Shouldn't the cost of educating tomorrow's generation be borne by all of us? Public education is at a crossroads. I've said that before. Our history of top-notch student test scores, rigorous learning standards, highly qualified teachers, and a well-educated workforce is on the line. Will we find the resolve and the revenue to fund schools adequately, or will we allow this excellent system to further erode? The choice is yours. I've attached to my testimony an editorial that was written by the Oregonian and published this morning that I think addresses in very specific terms why we believe the budget that was sent to you from the House fails the test to meet the needs of Oregon students and demystifies the claims made about the House version of funding. Tomorrow, as I said, you'll be hearing from some of our educators and from citizens throughout the state about those two numbers and how they compare and what the losses will be for each of those local school districts from whence they come. And I'd like to make one final point, and that is these budgets assume a freeze in salary for all education employees, and also for the health benefits. Now, health increase premiums are increasing anywhere from 12 to 20% in districts around the state. And I'd like to put that on the record that, in effect, when there is no money allocated for the cost of health care, you are actually giving employees a salary cut to the tune of the difference. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Vice Chair.
Senator Gordley.
Thank you very much. I believe I heard you say very softly at the beginning of your testimony that you are down 1,000 members. Did I hear that correctly?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, yes, that's correct.
That's the first time I've heard that number, and I'd like if you could prepare for us some information that tells us how many teachers or other staff are counted in that number, distinguish between retirements, layoffs, give us some breakdown or affirmative action, and then if you are able to tell us, where did the people go? What happened to them? Are they still in Oregon taking other work, unemployed? If you could give us, and is, over what period of time did we lose the 1,000? Is this since, over what period of time did this take place? That would all be very helpful.
Right.
In rounding out the picture that, in the point that you've made about the economic impact.
Mr. Chair and Senator Gordley, some of that information I think we have. I can tell you the last question you asked, this was just in the last year, and it was due to layoffs.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Further questions? David?
Thank you. Good afternoon. Vice Chair Harper, members of the committee, my name is David Williams, here representing the Oregon School Employees Association in opposition to the current appropriation contained in House Bill 5077A. OCA, as you may know, represents over 20,000 classified and certified employees in the state, the vast majority of them in Oregon's public K-12 and education service districts. Let me get straight to the point, and that is that the level of funding for Oregon's K-12 system contained in this bill is woefully inadequate and does nothing to solve the problems facing our schools. The bill appropriates a level of funding nearly identical to the amount that was allocated for schools 4 years ago, providing a level of service far below what was provided to students only 2 years ago. According to the Superintendent of Public Instruction and through the quality education model, and the numbers you all know, of course, that it would take nearly $5.6 billion to get us back to the level of services provided prior to last year's special sessions. This, as I might add, is a number that includes PERS savings from the actions that the legislature has taken, an optimistic assumption about health care costs, and the spike in teacher retirement. Furthermore, as Ms. Wilmer-Whalen has noted, in order to meet the 90% of students meeting standards, and this doesn't take into account the No Child Left Behind 100%, the state would need $6.5 billion. House Bill 5077A represents a fundamental disconnect between funding and outcome. Services, whether we like it or not, are intrinsically linked to funding levels. The superintendent has said that 5.05 is settling for second best. We might put forth that it's more like 36th best. Not only is the funding level contained in House Bill 5077A inadequate, there are several components of the bill that OSCA opposes. The bill includes an assumption that the state will expand video lottery games in our state lottery system, thus continuing our reliance on unstable small sources of revenue to fund broad-based services. And furthermore, rather than allocating the full dollar amount to schools, the bill allocates $50 million to the e-board in a sort of effort to capture federal grant dollars that may or may not increase over the biennium. And lastly, the supposed extra $250 million that is available through triggers is a myth that will never come to reality. In order for schools to actually realize these dollars, the state's economy would have to grow by nearly $800 million in the biennium. And anyone who has lived through the last 2 years knows that this is merely a pipe dream. Not to mention that if it were actually to take place, it would have to come off the 05-07 budget, as such an increase would, by law, trigger a kicker refund, perpetuating a pattern of borrow and spend that began with the first special session last year, and highlighted again today by the state treasurer. Lastly, House Bill 5077A does not even begin to address the long-term funding crisis that is facing Oregon's pre-K through 14 education system, and I might add all social services provided by the state. It would be a crucial failing of this legislature to adjourn without addressing the systemic and crippling problems facing the state. Last summer, OSCA asked legislative candidates to sign a pledge to solve school funding in Oregon. Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee, you should be buoyed in your efforts to seek adequate and stable funding for schools by the knowledge that 15 of your colleagues and 34 colleagues in the House agreed that our education system is at a moment of crisis and signed OSCA's school funding pledge. While a three-fifths majority is required for any revenue increase, we believe that this is a base from which you can build towards ensuring success of all Oregon students, present and future. The harsh reality of the situation that I hope is beginning to sit in with everyone is that the amount of money available for the state for K-12 funding and for the entire state budget is simply not enough, not by a long shot. I appreciate that a discussion of revenue is not directly in the purview of this committee. However, it is in the jurisdiction of the legislature, and that is what the situation calls for, a renewed and dedicated debate about raising money for the state, both for the short term, the 2003-04 budget, as well as for the long term. Vice Chair Harper and members of the committee, the Oregon School Employees Association, supports a level of funding for K-12 education that allows schools to operate a full year with reasonable class sizes, fair pay for all employees, and most importantly, a level that allows all students to achieve and learn. We support the quality education model and the levels that are outlined through that model that are needed in order to provide a world-class education system for all Oregon children. It is a courageous stand to say that education is a priority and to then actually fund our schools to a level that will provide quality education for all students. We must not simply balance the budget. We must find the way to provide the services that Oregonians have deemed valuable and necessary. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further questions?
Madam Chair, Mr. Vice Chair.
Mr. Gordley.
I just want to say that both of your testimony is it's excellent, and appreciate what you've brought to us. And as I recall, the OSEA pledge, the Oregon School Employees Association pledge, also included a pledge that we would not vote for sine die until there is a school funding solution. So I would just remind us of that, or at least remind those of us who signed on to the pledge. And again, just very appreciative of your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you.
Further questions, Mr. Messerman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, or Vice Chair. I really don't have a question. I just am compelled to make a statement here, I guess. And with the testimony we've heard today and will continue to hear tomorrow, there are some very valid concerns about how we fund our services in the state of Oregon and the ballot measure 5 and all those issues that have built mandates that voters have put on our table that are taking general fund dollars out of the state. But an issue that we're not hearing enough about, in my opinion, is what are we doing about our economy? How are we getting people back to work? What are we doing about the Elliott State Forest, which is mandated by law to provide funds for the Common School Fund? We're seeing in our Budget Committee and Natural Resources that the revenue is dropping off and the cost of managing that forest is rising. In the Northwest Forest, Senator Duke's area, we're seeing the values of those forests being diminished by demands of many, many people that say we should harvest less and less from those forests to provide funds to the state of Oregon. When you consider what that means to the communities, the jobs that puts into our communities, the general fund, the taxes those people pay to put back into our state economy, I think we have to address that issue. We've seen that decrease for the last 10 years plus in my communities and my Senate district for the last 20 to 25 years. We've seen our economies continue to collapse. I hear time and time again our natural resources such as the Biscuit Fire, the millions of dollars of value that we are not able to harvest, even though those trees now are destroyed. The longer we wait, the more value is lost. Another year or two, there will be so much disease in those trees, there will be no value. It's these kind of basic issues that I think this state better wake up and start facing, because we're not going to pull ourselves out of this simply with the high-tech industry. It's going to go through its own cycles, too. We can't pull ourselves out of this thinking that the I-5 corridor and the metro area is going to solve and pay for all the costs of the state. We have to bring the economies up statewide, or we're just not going to see resolution to our problems. Thank you.
Feel better?
I do.
All right. Any further questions?
I just think that's an amen.
Wait. Frank?
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair.
You got to wait every third time.
at some point in this discussion, I would like to have an analysis of the LFO's House QEM model versus the model that reflects a different number.
Tomorrow.
Will we get that tomorrow?
Yes, we'll do that tomorrow. Yeah,
thank you. Thank you.
That'll be first up tomorrow.
Thank you.
Senator Winters.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I believe that the good senator really raised a very valid point. And I would hope that those who come to us and talk about the issue of funding, that they're also willing to talk about and assist us when we're talking about the economies. Oregon is in serious problems. We do not any longer harvest timber. We look at our food processing industry and what's happening in our agriculture community. And these were all at one time producing jobs and income. We're competing globally, and we have to go beyond just high tech. We have to be diversified, and I would hope that those who come to us and talk about this whole revenue issue, that you're also willing to work with us to in some of these other venues. We replanted the Tillamook Forest a lot of years ago with the understanding that it would be harvested. It is not. And yet those dollars were going into common school funds. I think that we need your help, too. And it can't just be one-sided. It has to be where we all recognize that there are problems in this state and that we're willing to work together to solve them. And I just have to say that because we always hear everyone coming to us and say, why don't you fund mine? I haven't had anyone come to us and say, you know what, we're willing to help put the oars in the water. We recognize that Oregon is in a serious situation, and we also recognize we can't do business the same way we've done the last 10 years, and we do need to invest in our in harvesting and some of the other issues.
Senator Devlin, you got something to get off your chest?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and just very...
And we have a number of how many, so we can't manage our time.
Just very short, Mr. Chairman, since my good colleagues to my left here commented. The good governor, when he probably had higher popularity ratings in this building than he has now, actually before his actual taking office, made a statement that I think we should remember, and that is that about the worst signal that you can say nationally as far as the future of the economy of this state is to be closing schools. Closing schools early does not say a good thing in terms of expanding business, and it doesn't say a good thing about businesses wanting to locate here. So I think we need to keep that comment in mind.
I appreciate that. But there is no free lunch if we don't have jobs, if we don't understand the nexus between a vibrant economy in the private sector. Our public sector will continue to suffer. So, you guys have to help us. We all have to work together to get this thing done. We can't have one without the other. That's trouble. There's one little bill that's stuck in Senate rules, timber harvesting bill. It creates 4,000 jobs, a couple hundred million, right, something like that, that we can't get past. That to me is such an obvious disconnect that if you guys could help us with that, we'd appreciate it.
A couple of minutes, we'd be there.
With that, okay. With that, we'll adjourn. We'll crank.